One of Canada's most accomplished and experienced politicians is Dan McTagg, the Liberal MP in the Pickering-Scarborough-Ajax area from 1993 to 2011 for John Chrétien and Paul Martin, two giants of Canadian politics. He's also the gas price wizard, and he's currently the president of Canadians for Affordable Energy, affordableenergy.ca, and he joins us today. Dan, how are you?
I'm very good and really pumped that I'm here with you today, Jim.
Yeah, likewise. Before we get to pipelines and oil and gas in Canada, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about the decision from Stellantis to move the plant from Brampton, who had been there for decades, to Illinois. And the CEO of Stellantis was on CNBC this morning and said they're responding to President Trump's desire to move more manufacturing to the USA. This comes in the piggyback after all levels of government invested billions of dollars in Stellantis for an EV plant. Talk about the decision to move the plant and what happens to all that money that we gave them.
Yeah, well, good question. That's some $15 billion, some of that for the Stellantis LG in Windsor, the big plant, which is still being built and looks like big empty shells for now. But the Brampton plant, I'm old enough to remember when it was the AMC plant building the Jeep back in 75, 76. So, and of course, they built a big, huge natural gas peaker plant right behind it to make sure that it and Brampton had enough power. And so the future looked very bright, especially with going to be EVs. But as we all know, Dodge, Stellantis, of course, a combination of Renault, Fiat, and the old Dodge Plymouth has really reneged on the idea that it can go forward with EVs. Now with the United States, not so much on the tariffs, but not going down this road of this dark, ridiculous path that Canada's been on of EV mandates. The United States are not going to shove electric vehicles down people's throats at costs and a loss of their independence, a loss of their finances. So as a result of that, it made building the EV charger at that plant. It made building the Jeep Compass at that plant impossible. And so for now, it's mothballed. We could see perhaps a scenario where I think, and I'm spitballing here, that maybe China will come in once the tariffs are removed. I believe they will be, depending on how this thing goes. And maybe they'll be assembling Chinese-made EVs there at some point. But for now, it's bad news, and it does signal a much deeper problem, malaise, that we have backed the wrong horse in Canada when it came to electric vehicles to begin with, all under the rubric of net zero, which our prime minister was very much a part of, as was the predecessor. And they're now realizing that this is crumbling right before them.
Well, this is, as someone who's lived in Ontario a long time and a Canadian worried about the future of the country, I'm worried about the future of the GM plant in Oshawa and the Ford plant in Oakville, two major manufacturing job producing companies in this country.
Well, let me tell you a little bit about those. I worked public relations for Toyota Canada before I was elected, so I know a little bit about this industry, a little bit more than the average backyard mechanic. But I can, and those who are making comments about the future, what concerns me is that the Oakville plant was an EV plant, now turned into a heavy duty plant. Only one shift. Oshawa down, reduced, lost its light duty, now doing the heavy duty trucks. Only one shift. Something changes, those plants could be shut down in a moment's notice. Now, they could be used as what we call flex plants or swing plants. That's an option if things get better. But I think the future is most uncertain for the automotive sector. And speaking of my old company, the largest exporter of vehicles to the United States, a company that said no to electric vehicles and grifting and getting all sorts of subsidies, borrowed money, much of it, in order to pay for these flight of fantasies. The reality is that for many of us, it's time for a very serious rethink of the automotive sector. By the way, I'm not worried about tariffs in the automotive sector, okay, simply because we created this automotive sector in a time in which there were terrible tariffs. There were tons of tariffs. That doesn't affect the elasticity of this particular industry. What's most important is when you lose a major component of your market, which is that nobody's going to buy EVs in the United States because they don't have to. Meanwhile, Canada's going to sit here a little bit like thumb-sucking dolts, having to figure out why we want to buy these and why we want to be forced to drive these things that no one apparently wants without massive subsidies.
So explain this to me and explain this to our viewers, Dan. I know the mayor of Parry Sound, we have a summer place there, and they said they simply don't have the infrastructure that for everyone, all the cottagers, to have electric cars. They wouldn't be able to do it. And I know I had to help our daughter move to Edmonton, and driving across Lake Superior in Western Canada, I didn't see any charging stations. Well, outside major cities, where do you charge an electric vehicle, Dan?
You don't. And where does a farmer with 2,000-4,000 acres of wheat charge up their combine in the middle of nowhere? The reality is it would take probably a quadrupling of the number of EV chargers we have before we could actually get to the point where it could critically displace reasonably internal combustion engines, which continue to be more and more and more efficient. I don't care about what it does for gasoline. I can tell you that when a four-cylinder can do what an eight-cylinder did 15 years ago, and when you see things, inventions that are, you know, way better than what we had with simply the invention of the catalytic converter some 50 years ago or 51 years ago, you know, vehicles are extraordinarily clean. They're extremely efficient. They can be 100% recycled. All of those things are not boxes you can check off when it comes to electric vehicles. And at the end of the day, you can't ask Canadians who are becoming poorer and poorer with greater and greater taxes with a government that has a spending problem to come somehow fork over more money so that people could virtue signaling their these woke rides. Look, there's a place for these things, maybe in downtown Toronto, but I would say in downtown Toronto, you should take public transit. But beyond that, this is not efficient. And China will eat our lunch on this and clean our clocks any given day. For those who want to drive an EV, fine, have at it, pay for it. And if you want to have China come in and dump those products in here, you know, understand there are implications for that as well. But at the end of the day, there's no substitution for an internal combustion engine. Why? We tried electric vehicles in the 1920s and we walked away from it. We were a lot smarter then. We need to chew down on some more smartening up pills these days.
Indeed. You know, your experience is extensive as an MP in the House of Commons, working for two of the great politicians this country's ever produced. And I guess for a lot of people, we don't understand the inner workings of the Canadian government very well because we just don't have access to it. How much money does the country make from the sale of oil and gas in this country?
Net about $25 billion. That's been the average over the past 4 or 5 years, with the exception of COVID and with the exception of the downturn that we did see back in 2014, 2015. But generally speaking, 20 to 25 net billion dollars going to federal, provincial, and even municipal coffers. Yes, municipalities pick up about, what, $2 billion for the green municipal funds and things like that. So everybody's in for the grift. And what it's why it becomes so odd that people want to kill the golden goose. Let's block pipelines. Let's have emission caps. Let's stop tanker bans. In the meantime, the Americans bring their oil down from Alaska around the down the West Coast. You couldn't imagine a more unserious, unthoughtful nation that that subscribes to this as we have with Canada. And the effect is telling. Our food banks are growing. Our joblessness, especially among youth, is ballooning to levels we haven't seen in 2 to 3 decades. And we are likely to see a major, major fiscal catastrophe on November the 4th. And as much as Mark Carney wants to tap dance around us and his friends and grifters want to, you know, say it's okay, we can break it into, you know, capital expenditures and, you know, day-to-day expenditures, the reality is when you hit a $100 billion deficit, the bond rating agencies are going to take that very seriously and start downgrading your credit. Then the fur is going to fly, because for up to now, they've been absolutely silent. They actually believed, Jim, can you believe this? We have bond rating agencies. So I'm thinking of Standard & Poor's. I'm thinking of, Morningstar, DBRS saying, the federal government can use the CPP, the Canada Pension Plan, collateralize these debt. They can't. I mean, come on, wake up. Someone needs to pick up what's happened here. Canada's in a very, very difficult position of its own making.
Earlier this year, I reread Pierre Burton's classic book, The Last Spike, about Canadians in the late 1800s doing the impossible in building a railroad from Ontario all the way to BC on unclaimed land. We as Canadians have found ways to do amazing things. Why did the pipeline become the four-letter word in Canadian politics that it's like the third rail all of a sudden even to talk about it?
Well, I think that's because we had the luxury of sitting back and saying, "Oh, everything's just fine. We can borrow and maintain our standard of living by borrowing more money and going deeper into debt," and not realizing that the very things that have made this country prosperous, unique, and enviable has to do with its resource sector. Look, countries come to Canada not because of our AI. They don't come here because they like our, you know, our state-of-the-art technology manufacturing. They're here because they want our natural gas. They want our wheat. They want our forests. If we can get some of our clean water, and they definitely want our energy. And when you have 12 of our best trading partners over and above the United States coming to Canada saying, can you please give us some natural gas and oil? And we say, no, there's no business case for it. What an absolute fraud to have made that kind of a commitment to deny the country trillions of dollars in economic opportunity. That to me is not just a betrayal of the future of this country, it's an abandonment of reason. And anybody who would have looked at this like I did and say, there's a reason why I don't want to be part of this Liberal Party is because it has gone so far to the left and become so much part of an agenda that is foreign to the country and devastating to the country that it's not recognizable. It's a mongrel of its former self. It's a cult. And unfortunately, Canadians are now going to start to pay a very heavy price for their ignorance and their elbows up.
You know, Dan, there's also a geopolitical aspect to what you're talking about. I know a lot of European countries say they will eagerly buy liquefied natural gas if there's a pipeline from Alberta to Churchill, Manitoba, and cut Russia right out and starve them financially. If they have no money, they have no war in Ukraine. That seems like a win-win to me as a Canadian.
It does. And on so many fronts, we could have been champions of this. Remember, I want your audience to know, Jim, we had 17 LNG projects long before the Americans had any. And back before it was trendy and considered long before Putin's designs on Ukraine became deadly evident. We had these projects, and one by one, they were quashed. We were told there's no reasonable grounds in which you can pass these things. We will regulate you to death. If that weren't enough, our courts will be used as a form of lawfare, warfare against these projects. And yet, the Americans, in my time, working at Gas Buddy, for instance, from 2014 to 2018, 2019, built seven of these projects in some of the hottest conditions that exist in the United States. You built them in places like Texas and Florida. You know full well that to liquefy requires an enormous amount of energy in order to get them to condense them, to cool them down. And so they built seven while Canada sat back, you know, sort of waiting for this thing to go by as we navel gazed and tried to pretend we were the international Boy Scouts when it came to climate, as if something like this is anything but a solution to the climate. Nevertheless, at the end of the day, it's really galling for Canadians. You sell your natural gas for $3 a million cubic meters to the United States. Cubic feet, I should say. Yes. They in turn sell it to Russia, to Europe to offset Russia for $15 or $16 million cubic feet. So we are suckers. Half of the stuff that's going to the United States is actually Canadian product, but we don't bother to bring it to process it to make it LNG. Now we have one project. But if you have to go through this many hurdles, no wonder no one wants to invest in Canada. And premiers like David Eby and his predecessor, the late John Horgan, used to say, we'll use every tool in the toolbox to block these pipelines or anything. To me, that is economic vandalism. And no premier and no person in this country should be allowed to stifle the interests of the many that come way before the interests and the selfishness and the woke ideas of a few.
And Dan, that's why I want you to educate me and the viewers. So you're in the government with Jean Chrétien, and you're the prime minister, you're the federal government. Do you not have the power to say, hey, this is a national economic emergency. We are building an oil pipeline to Prince George or a natural gas pipeline to Churchill, Manitoba, and you as a premier can't stop it?
Well, that's exactly what constitutionally we know they can't stop it, but they're going to play every other game to get to that point to discourage. I mean, business doesn't operate on the assumption that, hey, we can wait a couple of months before we actually get these things approved. If you're going to create a condition that makes it intolerable or difficult for them to make ends meet, then what they're going to do is pack up and go and not invest in the first place. Business isn't about playing political games. But if there's a political narrative of to keep it in the ground in the country or somehow CO2, life-giving CO2, you know, is somehow the target of your objective to basically stymie and deter resources from getting to the rest of the world, then the situation has become very apparent. What I'm saying in all this, Jim, to you and your viewers here, is that we are going to see full on the effect of woke policies on and ESG policies and not to a lesser extent DEI on our budget come November 4th. I'm watching that like a hawk because I know full well that's where the rubber meets the road. And all these ideas of Canada not being able to sell and shouldn't be able to sell its resources to the rest of the world is going to come back to haunt every single Canadian. No wonder the future looks very, very clouded.
But so this is where I get confused. As a Canadian, recently there was the much talked about, a much viewed meeting of Mark Carney in the Oval Office with Donald Trump, and they actually floated the concept of revitalizing the Keystone XL pipeline. If that does happen, I would imagine that's a big benefit to Canada to get that oil flowing down to the U.S.
I've spoken to some American officials, Pete Sessions, not too long ago, back in June, and said, when are the Americans going to build their end of the pipeline? The one that was approved by Trump, started to be built under Trump, destroyed by Biden. It's his first act, a signature act as president. He even sold some of the pipelines for metal and scrap for pennies on the dollar. When will the United States get around to doing it? Because that would be a $1.2 million a day injection to the Canadian economy. It would strengthen the Canadian dollar. And the question is now, are the Americans prepared to go with it? It takes no rhetoric to convince me how important pipelines were. Jim, I'm going to show you something. 1998, a guy named Dan McTague wrote this report. The report of the Liberal, report of the Liberal Committee on Gasoline Pricing in Canada. A week before that came out, in June 10th, so around the 3rd or 4th of 1998, two people came up to me very quickly before I was going to present the report, Paul Martin and Jean Chrétien, each individually, but within 10 minutes of each other, said, what the hell are you doing in this thing? Because it was caucus matter. There was a lot of MPs that signed up on this. And I said, well, what's the rush? They said, are you going after the oil industry? I said, no, I'm going after the downstream. I'm going after the play that they're making to try to destroy small independent gas retailers across the country. I have no interest in the upstream. I said, but why the rush? And Chrétien said he was happy that Martin pulled me aside and said, I'm not going to be able to pay down the deficit or meet our commitments globally if we don't sell more oil to the rest of the world. We need those pipelines and we need that industry. That's when we sold 2 million barrels of oil a day. We have the potential to go to 8 million, 9 million, 10 million barrels a day, displace the Russians, displace all the bad actors in the world, and provide a product that people want. Why is Canadian oil important? It's heavy oil, and you need it to produce diesel. No nation on the face of this planet can survive without diesel. Not your military, not your agriculture, not your transport. It is the global workhorse. Without diesel, you don't have a country. And without heavy oil, you don't have diesel. It's as simple as that.
And Dan, excuse me, but for younger Canadians who may not realize it, with the combination of you in the House of Commons and Jean Chrétien and Paul Martin, there was no deficit you guys took over.
We hit the wall in 1997, and it wasn't Mark Carney who claims that he had something to do with it. He wasn't even around in those days. It was Paul Martin in the provinces, and it was program review. We went through and said, we can't pay for these things, not because we want to make it hard for people or we want to impose hardship. We want to do it so these social programs are viable for generations to come. And it's exactly what we did. But we now have found ourselves in 2014, 2015 with a bastardization, if you will, of what the Liberal Party was, not a pragmatic party that couldn't understand finances and said, money's no big deal. Budgets will balance themselves, Justin Trudeau once said. They didn't care. They spent and they taxed and they've created a situation where we've depleted the resources of this country and our growth and our productivity is suffering. Not to mention the fact that we've embraced this ideology around net zero. That's extraordinarily pernicious to Canada. It's very deadly to us. It will have no solid or appreciable effect. It's destroyed the European markets. It's made light of our own industry here in North America. And for that reason, we were more pragmatic in those days. We understood things. We were more reasonable. We weren't part of, enraptured by the latest gadgets or great, wonderful ideas as to how we can command and control people and ensure that people didn't behave in a way that they thought was unnecessary, 15-minute cities and whatnot. But look, at the end of the day, it is about our future. Our economy is slipping. Our future is very much in doubt, and we can turn this around. But it's going to take the Liberal cult that's been around since 2015, I call them that, to swallow themselves whole and go back to where we were back in 20 years before that.
Dan, I have family in Nova Scotia, family in the Maritimes, and every time I visit, I'm always shocked at the price of gas of them down east. I understand there are super tankers that come from Saudi Arabia that bring oil to them.
Yeah.
So how many? I think about the environment. What is the carbon footprint of a super tanker bringing oil from the Middle East to the Maritimes?
It'll be a lot. So 300,000 barrels a day has to come to the Irving plant in St. John. So you'd have to think that that's the largest plant, by the way, on the East Coast of both Canada and the United States. Lesser extent might come by chance. And some might come from Basra, Iraq. Sometimes it might come in from Algeria. Sometimes you might find oil coming even from some of the shale plays in the U.S. barely making their way through. But what it does suggest to me is that we have, as a country, have sacrificed very much. And if you ask why the price of gas is so high, I every single day I keep showing this to people. You know, going back 30 years, I've tabulated day in, day out what the price of gas. There's one here. Just goes to show you how I calculate my information. That's probably not the best page because there's some written on it. Every single day, I know what the gas price is going to be. And all the one of the first things that I put in the top of this is the value of the Canadian dollar. So 136.25. Why is that important? Because the Canadian dollar is so weak versus the US greenback, it adds 24 cents a liter to the price of gasoline. Doesn't matter where you are in the country, even higher if it's HST. So not having a country that can sell products that the rest of the world wants, scaring investors, as we've allowed the lawfare green vandals to engage in, costs us not just for higher price for diesel and gasoline, but pretty much everything else. Think of your purchase power being eroded by the stupidity of people going out and saying Canada shouldn't produce more resources, shouldn't cut down more wood, shouldn't mine, shouldn't do any of these things because it might affect our carbon footprint. Listen, you'll choke to death on worrying about carbon footprints when the rest of the world is going to not pass us by.
You know, I get triggered when I'm at the drive-through at Tim's getting my coffee and I see someone throw garbage out the window. But I think I'm even more triggered thinking that there's super tankers traveling across the North Atlantic from Iraq and Saudi Arabia and Algeria when we could just ship it across our own country. I'm so confused why we don't do that.
Yeah, you would think that that would be a wise thing to do. A million barrels going to the West Coast. I mean, we'd have to build a coker, a heavy refinery to take heavy oil. By the way, United States loves our oil simply because they can't get it from Mexico. The wells there have turned sour. There's a lot of salt in them. There's water in them. There's contamination. And they can't get it from Venezuela. It's a basket case. Russia is not a possibility. Saudi Arabia is not interested in selling most of the stuff to the United States, to Asia, particularly to China. For Canada, the idea is that if we can get our product to the west, to the East Coast, in the same way we would get to the West Coast, we could double and triple our output. All it takes is for people to back off. But if we're going to have provinces stick up and say, no, 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 unless we get some more grift, or even if they are getting the grift, they still say no, then I think that's going to lead to unnecessary tensions in the Federation, the likes of which we're seeing, which I'm not so much concerned about Alberta separating. I'm more concerned about Alberta saying, all right, you want to play that game? We're getting out of the CPP. We're pulling out of the Canada Pension Plan. We'll make our own pension plan. Watch your pensions go up in smoke. So how much more ignorance and how much more, how can Canadians be duped with this idea of elbows up when the very thing that makes our nation tick, our resources, are being stymied by hucksters who walk around, access to our pockets, access to our government pensions, access to everything, basically taking advantage of the situation to push their narrative, which has no business being in Canada of all places, a nation with the third largest pool of reserves of energy in the world.
Dan, but this is where I get so confused. Here's Mark Carney, Harvard educated, Goldman Sachs. I mean, deep, deep roots into the economy and finance. Surely he must see the benefit of a pipeline and selling oil and gas and how it would help the bottom line.
Well, he's the guy that's been selling us down the river for quite some time and going after this industry and making it very clear in his book that he's all about shutting down fossil fuels altogether. And he has a lot of allies, had a lot of allies. He has fewer and fewer now as people are starting to realize the totality of the costs and impact and the attempt at trying to force civilization back on its heels. The reality, I think, for the Mark Carneys is that they're going to have to swallow themselves whole, realize that their experiment on net zero has been an abject failure, has done nothing but damage to the country as it has around the world, and will not create any reasonable impact on the weather. So, you know, I say to people right now, I've been doing gas price predictions for 30 years now. and I've got the chops to prove it. And I'm saving a lot of people a lot of money along the way. No hurricane this year. Nothing affecting the U.S. Gulf Coast. So much for climate change. I mean, look, I was there in Louisiana in 2005 when Hurricane Wilma and Katrina smacked the daylights out of that region. A few years later, Hurricane Ike did the same thing, caused prices to go all over the place. You can't use those excuses. The climate idea is not there. Hey, Greta Thunberg's too busy going out throwing herself into terrorist territory in Gaza. She doesn't care about the environment anymore. So, look, the ruse is over. It's time to get real. No more consultations, negotiations. I expect Mark Carney to announce the development of two or three new projects. If he doesn't, that he will definitely be shown the door, or Canadians will be shown the door to poverty for being so stupid and gullible.
For his own political survival and maybe a sort of a political poker game with Trump, do you envision that he would come together with a Keystone XL pipeline deal so to appease Trump and maybe appease Alberta and appease the resource industry in this country?
Well, the pipeline's built right to the border, from Hardisty all the way to the U.S. border. It's just a matter of the Americans fitting it in at their end. That's what was killed by a presidential decree, both by Obama and again by Biden. So the Democrats, like the Liberals in Canada, hate pipelines, but don't mind spending billions of dollars in putting countries in debt in order to service their social programs and all their campaign wishes. I would think that Mark Carney doesn't have much of a choice, especially with the reproposed Northern Gateway. If he says no or prevaricates on that and doesn't show a single sign of change, I would suggest that Alberta won't be waiting for the rest of Canada to elbows up. I think they're basically going to take their marbles and leave. And I don't just mean leave in the sense of a political thing. I think there's a lot of other things Alberta can and will do. And I don't think British Columbia, when a new government is there, or for that matter, Saskatchewan, will be very far behind. I think they've had a raw deal. I'm not from there. I don't like the industry. I predict gas prices every day that hurts that industry. But if you do with oil and gas, I'm going to tell everybody now, I know it's warmer weather here in Ontario, but why don't you go outside and turn your gas meter off, turn off your propane, and see how your little windmills and solar panels built in China work? Because at the end of the day, we are looking to make a retrograde step backwards that will fall with our level of prosperity back to days of poverty. And I know what that's about. I was here in 1981 when we saw 22% interest rates. That's where we're heading again, or worse.
If I, just to wrap up, Dan, if I could wave a magic wand and make you prime minister, even if you lifted all the restrictions, from a realistic timeline standpoint, how long would it take to complete a pipeline to Prince George and Churchill, Manitoba, and get those resources flowing?
Usually about a year, year and a half. If you've got everybody out of the way, a year and a half. And you know what? The amount of money needed to get that momentum going would be there. The stimulation would be almost immediate. We'd also see a rise in the value of the Canadian dollar. So that cost of hamburger, that cost of orange juice, the cost of pretty much everything else would also decline. Why? Again, when it takes 140 pennies to buy one U.S. dollar, that is a direct attack on your bottom line, on your budgets, on your own family budgets. It would also ensure that, as things get better, we would see a little lower interest rates as opposed to rising interest rates, because the government's taking on far more debt federally and provincially than we've ever seen in the past as a proportion of the value of the dollar compared, measured in current dollars.
And I would think there's a massive trickle-down effect to all the communities where the pipeline goes through, and the First Nations communities, and the resources and the money they make along the way.
Yeah, so 191 bands involved with the stuff going from Alberta all the way to British Columbia. Nine are opposed. The rest are unanimously in favor. I'm sorry, but the interests of the many come before the selfish, delusional interests of the few. And we cannot have that zero-sum game where it has to be unanimity. And I've heard that from Mark Carney. There's no such thing as unanimity in this country. It can never be. We do things by consensus. If we don't do them, get the hell out of the way. And if you're not prepared to get the hell out of the way, stop cashing the checks from the federal government and from the source of the revenues that this industry produces. And that is a call to my friends, mes amis, les grands amis, du province de Québec. If you don't like pipelines, we know you do, but your political actors don't. well, then maybe you should stop asking for $14, $15 billion every year in equalization. And I, it has to be put on the line because this is insane. We can't continue to diminish ourselves by playing one region off against another for political reasons.
Well said. He is Dan McTagg. He is the president of the Canadians for Affordable Energy, affordableenergy.ca, the gas price wizard. Dan, always I enjoy our insights and our conversations. Thank you very much, my friend.
Good to be here, Jim. Thanks for having me once again.